I'm a working man. I gotta pay my bills.
I don't know what we're yelling about!
Oh, look at me! The millionaire who goes to see doctors!
You filthy animal.
What is this, a prey? The game is cold, but
it's crazy. And don't you ever forget, you're free to do what we tell you.
What in God's holy name are you blathering about?
The only thing I think of when I think of my kids growing up in this country, if they say, Dad, what do we have left that's American-owned? And I say, son, I mean, there's not much to choose from, but that's what we have Pabst Blue Ribbon for.
Child, please.
Pass the Gravy, episode 51. It's Alex and Cole here. Curtis, once again, did not make the trip. Still on his hiatus for Christmas, I think. We've got, joining us for the third time, friend of the show, Kevin Bartini. What's going on, buddy?
Hey, man, how are you? Thanks for having me on again.
It's good to have you back.
I know. I'm basically a co-host at this point. Three times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You might as well be just mentioned on the podcast anyways, right?
Right. That's right.
So you are here because you just released today, actually, your new comedy album, the Unintentionally White Album.
Yes, sir. Just came out today. Available on iTunes and wherever fine tchotchkes are sold online.
We got a chance to listen to it beforehand, and it was fantastic. We were laughing the whole time, and it's something that it's kind of stuff that everybody kind of agrees with. And you're like, yeah, that family shit, I have that too.
Thanks, man. Yeah, it's a little it's my second album, and it's definitely more personal than the first one, more about my own life and my worldview, and much more than the first one, which was kind of more just a collection of the best bits I had written as I was learning to do comedy and coming up. You know, it took me, I waited about 10 or 11 years before I did the first one, and then this is, once I had my chops, this is what I was able to do in the 3 years afterwards. And so I recorded it back home in a in front of a hometown crowd, in a smaller venue, like a black box theater, because I think it's a little bit more intimate of an album, and it was a lot of fun to do that night, and I'm happy with the way it turned out. So I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah, it really did seem intimate because you could just feel that the crowd was right there with you the entire time, and you could hear people gasping, oh my God, like laughing, and you could just feel the energy from however the album was recorded.
Yeah.
I thought that was awesome for it.
Yeah, man, we did the – thank you. Yeah, we did the audio recording was done through the cameras, so I didn't have a mic pack on me just to get my voice, and we didn't get or anything like that. We didn't have a special mic set up. It all came from the cameras, which were within the room. So then the audio, my audio, was taken from the one that was closest to me, and so even there, you're still picking up the sounds of the audience when I'm talking. And then the other mics were from the back, so it mixed down into a cool sound, so you really get the effect like you're right sitting in the room.
Yeah, absolutely. It was organic in the best possible way.
Yeah, and it's fun for me to listen to it because I was doing it at home. I can actually pick out laughs and know who, you know, some of the people like you're saying, the gasp. And hearing that when somebody talks, like I know who that is. I can pick that out, which is kind of cool. And especially because my grandparents, I'm 35, and I still have three of my four grandparents, and they were all there, and I can hear both of my grandmothers laugh at different points, which is kind of cool.
That is awesome. I'm really close with my grandmother, and like I heard a lot of grandma talk, so like that instantly grabbed my attention. I thought it was so awesome.
Yeah, it's nice. It's nice that they're still around, that they get to see some of my success. It's kind of cool to share it with them.
But when your grandparents are listening to your comedy, at what stage were you kind of like, hey, look, I curse, and you're going to just kind of have to get used to that? Or were they kind of like that anyways? They didn't really care to begin with?
At the beginning, it was... They came to see me early on and stuff, and so they've seen me grow And they understand what stand-up is. They're not prudes.
You're not so much a dirty comic either. It's more intelligent stuff, but it's you just use those words to point out things.
I've refined over the years. I've never used language for shock value. That's not my style. But I talk on stage the way I talk in real life. So I may, you know, there's probably a dozen superfluous fucks in that album, you know, because it's just the way I talk. And when I'm talking, I say fucking this at some point. So, you know, it's that kind of stuff. So I remember one of my grandmothers, at one point gave me a little bit of grief for it years ago. And she, you know, she kind of says, oh, well, you know, Ray Romano doesn't do that. He's her favorite. You know, Ray Romano doesn't curse and all that. I was like, well, you know, that's good for Ray Romano.
It's so easy to get to that point, too.
Yeah, exactly. Good for Ray Romano. I'm not that. So we'll you know. But they're cool with it. And they're just, at this point, they're just so excited to see, you know, to go into a theater where, you know, it's all about their grandson, that they just really get off about that. Or you know, I don't tell them when another newspaper article is coming out and stuff. So they just open the paper one morning and there's my big mug on there. So they get off on that kind of stuff for sure.
Especially to get to see you up close after seeing how much you've had success elsewhere, like with Colbert and with The Daily Show and all of that.
Yeah. It's nice that it's, you know, I'm fortunate that there's longevity in my family so that like them and my parents and my grandparents and all of these people are able to see a bit of the success. It's definitely a special thing to share it with them.
And to realize how much of your material they've become.
Yeah, a little bit. They're a little bit in there, huh?
So you can get that on Amazon, iTunes, your website, mm-hmm. KevinBartini.com, right?
Yeah, the easiest thing is just to go to KevinBartini.com and find the link right there. But yeah, it'll be available on – as we're recording this, it just came out this morning. And I know at the stroke of midnight it was on iTunes. It hadn't gotten onto Amazon yet, but it should be there by the end of the day or tomorrow. I don't know. Each of them takes their own special amount of time to get off their ass and get things listed. Right. So within a week's time, it'll be on like 80 sites. It just, you know, but that's why I just say go to KevinBartini.com. You can find it easy enough.
Well, the most recent time you were on our podcast, you were talking about the unveiling of George Carlin Way, and we haven't gotten to talk to you since then. But we had Adam Lash on who was there, and he kind of filled us in, and I know that everything went awesome. But how many times have you been by George Carlin Way since then?
Honestly, not as many times as you would think. It's it is in my neighborhood, but there's a park in between my apartment and George Carlin Way that has a shitload of stairs, so I don't walk over there as often. What happens a lot of times is when I'm driving around my neighborhood looking for parking, I start on my block and work my way out, and eventually go to the other side of the park. So I don't think I've gone out of my way to go just to see it, but I have driven past it a number of times looking for parking for sure. And I'm always amazed when I get there that it's still there. Nobody sold sign.
It's not been defaced or anything either.
It's up pretty high. It is up pretty high, I got to tell you. So it would take a bit of ingenuity and quite a stealth operation to get somebody to shimmy up that pole, take it down, and get away with it before anybody catches them. So I think it's safe. But that being said, it is right next to, you know, dormitories, frat houses, everything. It's like I just figured that was going to be – it's a – George Carlin Way sign right in the middle of basically a college campus. I'm like, that thing is – I told him. I was like, that thing has to be hung super high or you have to be rehanging one every Monday morning.
They're going to need a lot of these.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I feel like if I were you, I would just be walking up and down that street and be like, hey, you know, this is largely because of me.
Yeah.
Largely because of me, guys. I just wanted to wave my hand.
Yeah, it's me. Then you get a hell lot of who cares? Who gives a shit? People probably still pissed at that one afternoon that they weren't allowed to park on the street because
You motherfucker.
Yeah, exactly.
So did you have to just go to like city planners or whatnot to kind of pitch that or what? I think Alex has talked to you about it before, but I wasn't here for that. So I'm just kind of curious.
Yeah, no, it's a pretty involved process. You have to go through a community board, which each neighborhood has, and then within the community board, they have different committees. So just if you picture a community board kind of like the way Congress works, it starts at a subcommittee, and once it gets out of the subcommittee and gets approved by them, it gets voted on by the community board as a whole. And then from there, once they've passed it, then it gets sent to the city council, and the city council votes on it as a whole. And they then, once they've approved it, send it to the mayor to sign into law. So it took us, what usually takes 18 months took us 3 years because of the community board. The lowest level was where we ran into our troubles, and we had a big public battle with the Catholic Church and all that fun stuff. But once we got it out of that board, that was the hardest vote. Once we got it out of that, the community board, you know, passed it. City Hall, they passed it unanimously, and then the mayor was happy to sign it. So,
wow.
Yeah, it took quite a while. Yeah, about 3 years. Dang. From start to finish.
So I guess Bloomberg wasn't a fan of George Carlin then initially, is what we're saying.
It wasn't. No, it was during Bloomberg's term, but it was de Blasio who signed off on
okay,
it.
Okay, yeah. Okay, cool. I wasn't sure whenever the... whenever he passed the torch on to de Blasio. But anyways,
yeah.
So last night I became privy to your Bro Bible article.
Can I just break in real quick?
Sure.
Cole has had a bit of a man crush on you, let me just say. He kind of has a lot of similar interests, I feel like. And when he was researching you and looking up for this interview, he was just like, dude, I can't believe, did you know he did this? And I was like, yeah, man, I've interviewed him before. Like, he's really excited to talk to
yeah,
you.
Yeah, yeah. I do a lot of film criticism and whatnot too. Okay. And when I heard about the movie preview review podcast,
it's
a pretty awesome idea. And so I kind of wanted to implement a little bit of that, not necessarily in the same vein as that, but I've wanted to implement stuff about film and media topics because I'm way more into that than discussing like politics or like typical news, because I feel that just kind of goes over my head. So, so I was implementing that. And then whenever he said, inform me about your podcast, I really wanted to kind of, you know, play with that a little bit and talk about Inherent Vice, 'cause I saw that movie the other day. But, but first, that's kind of where he was talking about. I wanted to talk about the Bro Bible article.
Okay.
And
sure.
So what I liked about that, and this is gonna kind of come full circle, I guess, when we get into later segments of the podcast, is how you spoke about just the different people that had showed up to that show, and seeing Bradley Whitford and Ken Burns almost spilling coffee on you and whatnot, and I think that's really funny, and a lot of the stuff that it can be construed as is name dropping, but it was also tender, and it wasn't a way to say, oh, look who I encountered. It was just the all encapsulation of that night. And I felt the passion in the work, and I felt that the entire article was also funny, yet it was conversational and tender. And so can you kind of expound a little bit about what that night meant to you and just the experience of the craziness of everything like that and just the
yeah. Whole... Yeah. Well, I mean, well, first of all, the article was basically the article was about the last night at the Colbert Report, and I'm the warm up guy. There, it was such a wonderful show to be a part of, just from start to finish. You know, I've worked for them for the last couple of years, and before them, it was the Daily Show, and I was such a fan of Stephen, of the Colbert Report, of the Daily Show, of Jon Stewart, of everything. I was a fan of the Daily Show since it debuted in the late 90s, you know, in the Craig Kilborn days. I watched it, you know, religiously, and it's I love consistency. I love when people are consistently funny or consistently a virtuoso at what they do, and what I love about my job is that you know, even as a stand-up, I get to, you know, every night you never know who's going to be on the bill, or especially back when I was a feature, you know, when you go to a club for the weekend, you know, who are you going to be opening for? Who that I've idolized since I was a child am I now going to get to know, and that kind of stuff. And so to get into audience warm-up is a really awesome job for a comedian for a number of reasons, you know. But when you're able to do it, and then to do it for a show that you're a huge fan of, it's, I don't know really how to, you know, what to compare it to. It's like if you grew up a Yankee fan and all of a sudden you're getting to play for the team, you know. It's something amazing. So I've been so fortunate that I've been able to have time. I was able to travel with the Daily Show when they went to the presidential conventions. I was able to you know, stand there off camera and watch some amazing interviews with amazing guests, and then Colbert, to be backstage to watch their rehearsals, to be a part of it. Because I, you know, I'm such a fan of the show, I would have paid money just to get a ticket to go to a taping of those shows, if that's what it took.
Yeah.
You know, so there's that real surreal aspect of it. And then the final night, I wanted, you know, they asked me to just write a little fly on the wall piece about what that night was like. And I don't really go in on celebrity. I don't care about celebrity. I'm jaded to it at this point. I've been around and I've met so many people. Like I said in the article, I have my fair share of people who I knew before they got famous. I understand that, you know, what celebrity is. And then you have people who are famous just to be famous and cheapen celebrity in general.
Yeah.
So just the fact that you're famous doesn't impress me. There is something to be said of you're in a confined space, a small room, and every person in that room is famous, and most of them are not, you know, none of them were Kardashians. Everybody was famous generally for having earned it, for having been a virtuoso at what they've done. And so, you know, it was really cool. You know, I tried to paint the picture a little bit by, you know, that one moment where I'm just standing outside the stage door and you know, this surreal moment of Kissinger and Barry Manilow and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Willie Nelson walking past me in succession. It's like, where the hell does that ever happen?
Yeah, absolutely. It just kind of seemed like what I liked so much about it is like, well, these are just guys. You know, they're incredibly talented people. But you know what? Willie Nelson's just a guy, you know? And I like that. I like kind of looking at it from that perspective. Like, you know, he doesn't want everyone just to gloat and, you know, whoever it may be. Bryan Cranston doesn't want people just to say, oh my God, you were in Breaking Bad. Yes, I get it. I was in Breaking Bad. Okay. But
yeah.
I like that approach to it. And you just don't see that much. You see when people really want to coast upon that likeness so much. And no. I think that just the way that article is written, it was just really refreshing to me. And that's what I gravitated toward so much. So anybody that's listening, I highly recommend the article. I thought it was absolutely fantastic and awesome fly on the wall perspective.
Thank you. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, like I said, having had many run-ins and experiences on all different levels with people in all different levels of celebrity and whatnot, the best advice I could ever give to you if you're in a situation with someone who you really idolize is just remember they're just a person. They have interests outside of whatever it is that you know them for. You know, I'm a huge fan of The West Wing, and you know, I talked to Bradley Whitford for 20 minutes that night, and we only briefly touched on The West Wing, you know,
because
it's like people have so much more to their lives, and for that, you know, I don't ever aspire to be world famous. I think there's a part of celebrity that's a curse. That's a prison sentence. I mean, if you think of guys who've been, you know, things that we take for granted, you know, just running out in the middle of the night, down to the gas station because you need to get a gallon of milk. You know, something that we can do without thinking twice about it. But, you know, Paul McCartney can't do that because him running to the corner store to get milk involves him stopping for photos with 30 people, signing autographs, and answering the same question about, you know, what it was like to be a Beatle. You know what I'm saying? Like,
that's got to be obnoxious.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, yeah, I mean, or just like running to Walmart. Maybe not so much in your case, as we know, like on the album, but like, yeah, just like going to Walmart and picking up a bread loaf or, whatever you got, allergy medicine. But it's crazy. It's crazy to think about it from that perspective.
So if you're ever in that situation where you actually end up talking to somebody who you idolize and who's famous, just talk to them, you know, about sports. Ask them about something else, and you will get into a conversation, you know, and they will leave that conversation not annoyed at you that, ugh, here's one more person and I have to regale with the story. Yeah.
I've got to take another picture.
Yeah, absolutely. Like in the realm of film criticism,
mm-hmm.
So we get commissioned through publicists to speak to a lot of talent, and it's awesome. But I kind of think that there are critics out there that there will be like they're called either quote whores or people who – like who always want to brag about that, oh, you know, today I talked to Joseph Gordon-Levitt about this. And to me, it kind of gets to the point, like, there are critics who are much more notable than I am and have bigger outlets and audiences than I do. And I'm just like, man, you know, like, do you really have to remind me every time? It just kind of seems a little like, I don't want to say desperate, but I don't really know. How were you describing it earlier, Alex? You had something
like
really...
they try and validate themselves by people they've been around.
Yeah, and to me, and that's not really why I got into this. Like, I got into... you know, stuff like this to have a conversation with people and to talk about things and form a good dialogue and whatnot. And
you're talking about other reviewers talking like that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I see it on like especially Facebook and stuff like that. And they'll tag other people and not, you know, they'll promote like an article or something that they wrote, but like the tag or something like that kind of just seems like more like look who I'm in cahoots with rather than look at this great piece of work. I don't know.
Yeah,
and to me, I have a problem with that.
Exactly. Well, that's the whole celebrity culture, isn't it? I mean, that's what, you know, what paparazzi is. That's what you know, these people who make their entire living about, you know, about access to whatever star and that kind of stuff. There's a whole that's that mindless crap side of pop culture, which I detest you know, I remember, this is maybe a funny story, I don't know. There's a comedian named Jim David, who's a very funny comedian. And he and I was opening for him a few years ago, probably, I don't know, 7-8 years ago. And we're at a comedy club, and on the table there's a copy of Us Weekly. And, you know, just vapid, just the worst of exactly what you're saying, and just... such empty calories, keeping account each week at that time of, you know, whether Britney Spears and Justin Timberlake were going to break up or not. You know, that ridiculousness. Yeah. Something just so stupid and who wore a best or whatever. And I just looked at the magazine and I just said to Jim, I said, Jesus, can you imagine how awful it would be if your career was to write for this magazine, you know? If every day that's what you had to concern yourself with, is what is this celebrity doing? What's this celebrity baby? Who gives a shit? You know, that's, for some people who write this, that's their entire lives. That's what they're obsessed. So I'm like, can you imagine how much it would suck to have to live to that, live through that and be that? Jim picked up the magazine. He opens to page 68 and he points to his picture as one of the writers. But it was different though, because he was just just did it to mess with me. But he was writing like they would have comedians as guest commentators, like on fashion or something, like literally, like the one like who wore it best or what were they thinking, and so he threw them a few jokes. He isn't a guy who spends, and he knew what I was meaning. You know, he isn't a full timer or anything like that. He submitted a few jokes for a couple $100, but it was just a great way to shut me up and make me feel like an asshole for a minute by literally me talking out my ass and then him pointing to his picture.
Right.
So maybe it wasn't that bad of a gig then, you know?
Maybe. Well, if you're doing something like that, hey, I would do that. A couple $100, just write a couple jokes to submit about how somebody looks in a dress. Yeah, yeah. That's that's something I can do over my morning coffee and pay for my groceries and bills for the week. Yeah, I'm on. I would do that.
I say stuff like that, and I don't get paid for it most of the time.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, you can attest that. Writing is no joke, and it's incredibly hard to get to articulate things because it's completely different rather than like writing. Because I had to do a lot of academic writing in the past, like coming from academic writing to writing a review or like trying to throw in something satirical or funny in there, and it's incredibly difficult to do that. And rather than like writing for comedy or for writing for a piece like you did for Bro Bible, there's just so much more into it that is really difficult to kind of navigate your way through. And it's really admirable. I think I saw you tweet out, a friend of yours wrote for a website. I think The Dissolve is one I go to a lot, last week. And that to me kind of finds a really good happy medium of writing, intelligent writing, but also making it relatable and conversational. So to me, acting like you're talking to somebody, I think, is the hardest part, rather than saying, oh, you know, I think that I'm just inherently, you know, that I should make myself an authority on this film criticism thing, because it's hard to kind of find a voice in that, and not necessarily just criticism, but just in general in comedy. I mean, I'm sure you can attest to that, like finding your own voice and finding out exactly about what you want to do and, you know, and just the process of what it takes to be a person in the media. I don't know. It's really difficult to me.
Yeah. You know, I've done a lot of, at this point, writing for hire, you know, where I'll ghost write for other comics, or I'll even, just cause it says it on my in my Twitter bio that I'm a writer for hire. You know, I've had guys contact me, and I've done wedding toasts. I've done, corporate things, you know, whatever it is. Some of it's not even funny. Some of it's just a job. But yeah, it can be quite difficult. And you just, you know, it's just one of those things for me, as difficult as it is, the main most important step is just to sit in front of your computer and type words, just type thoughts and words until you've got 1,000 words or 2,000 words, and then just kind of go back and cut and paste and move things around and edit and tighten it. And that's basically how I do it. It's 2-3 drafts and I'm done with whatever it is, and punch it up, and then, you know, go back and look at it the next day or a few hours later, whatever you have time for, and look at it with some fresh eyes. But I just go at it just as it's a job. It's if I don't do this, I don't get paid. So I have to figure out how to write for whatever the assignment is.
Yeah. What came first for you? Was it the comedy or was it the writing?
Comedy. I mean, comedy came very early. I was like 19 when I started. Uh-huh. And I always wanted to be a comic as a kid. Stand up came first, and then once I was doing stand up in the city for a while, and starting to, you know, make connections and make my reputation, then other opportunities started to show up. I think the next thing that happens, and probably happens for a lot of guys, is the younger comics, the ones who show a spark. The older comics will, you know, give them jobs, mm-hmm. writing gigs here and there. I've done it myself. Like when I you know, was getting my podcast up and running or something, I would have other comics, you know, like, here's the movie I'm on a review, take a look at it and just write me some jokes. Write me a couple pages of jokes about this movie, about anything about it, and pitch them to me. And if I like them, I'll incorporate them into my work. And if I don't, well, that's all right. And that's really how it kind of started with me, was other guys going on to, you know, especially like going on to like Keith Olbermann's show when it was on, and, mm-hmm. you know, and here's the subjects we're talking about, and I'm going on in 3 hours, so give me 10 jokes on each. And you know, that it started there. And then from that, you know, you guys get to know you a little bit, you get a reputation, you do a good job, one guy recommends you to the next, and then the next guy, you know, you work for him for a little while and you do something, and then all of a sudden he gets some bigger opportunity, and the next thing you know, you're writing for HBO or you're writing for a Comedy Central roast or something like that. Mm-hmm. And one thing leads to the other. So I went from doing, you know, the Keith Olbermann stuff to writing the series for HBO. And then when that ended, I had built that muscle up of give me a subject, I can sit down and I can write 10 or 20 jokes on any subject. And I was doing it. So that's how my podcast came about. I was bored and I needed to do something to get my name out there more. So I was like, well, let's watch a preview and I can write 10 pages of jokes about that and put it in some order. And it's all been that. And to a lesser extent, that's how, you know, your next comedy special comes from that same kind of process. You know, it's all the same process.
Yeah. It's interesting to hear the trajectory of that sort of thing, because I think from, a lot of people, at least I talk to about comedy, and I'm by no means a comedian. I'm just a fan of comedy in general, to hear, you know, the hard work that goes into it. It's not like I just go up on stage and you know, the magic just flows out of me. It takes a lot of work, and a lot of the people that I listen to and whatnot, just hearing an inside baseball type of perspective, I think really kind of shines a light on how hard it is to do and how much talent goes into crowd work and, you know, making sure you don't, you know, step on somebody else's toes with a joke or whatever like that, because I heard a lot of talk about that a few years ago with, like, the Rogan Mencia kind of deal. And I don't know. It's really interesting to hear, like I said, an inside baseball perspective on the world of comedy. So I like hearing that kind of thing.
Yeah, it is. When you're doing comedy right, when you're doing, you know, stand-up right, it should appear to the audience like it's coming off the top of your head, you know? Mm-hmm. It should feel like they're in the moment, and you know. But yeah, the truth is, to do stand up, to be a good stand up, yes, it takes years and years of work, and it takes years and years of trying and failing and building up your skills and your muscles, so that things look effortless. Like, I can do crowd work effortlessly now, but that was because I trained at the Upright Citizens Brigade and I hosted shows in New York City for, you know, years and years and years. I've hosted thousands of shows and I've built up that muscle. And that's why when you see a guy who's not done a lot of crowd work, it can go off the rails and it can get uncomfortable and ugly. So yeah, there's so much work that goes into all of this, and beyond the work that goes into your craft and mastering your craft, right. Then there's all beyond that. Then there's the whole other side, which is the business side, which is, you know, all of the time you have to spend emailing and calling bookers and trying to get on their radar and trying to, once you're on their radar, to stay there and to try to get work, and then to battle each booker individually to bump you up from host to feature or feature to headliner, and then once you're a headliner to make them believe that you're worth getting more money, and then the travel and everything else. When you're watching it, when you're at the club, it should look easy. It should look like the guy just got up that morning, you know, and then came to the club and had these thoughts, and then he goes home to a charmed life. But the reality is, it's a very difficult business. That's you know, I've been in it 15 years, and it's still frustrating, difficult. It's not lucrative. For the guys who do it and the guys who stick with it, it's like a calling, really. It's what you are, it's what you do, and whether you make $10,000 this year or you know, $250,000, at some point it's down to fate and to luck which category you fall in. So for anybody out there who's thinking of getting into it and giving it a try, you know, understand that I'm 14 years in now, and it's still every day feels like an uphill battle, or feels like you're drowning, and somebody's you know, you're just waiting for somebody to throw you the next gig, the next life preserver, and before somebody throws you a life preserver, 10 other people are throwing you concrete blocks. You know what I'm saying? It's tough.
I was listening to a podcast, and I want to say it was Barry Katz talking, and he was talking about when he used to represent Louis C.K.
Uh-huh.
How he said that when Louis was like 18, he was like, I just wish I could have told him, in like 30 years, you will be world famous.
Right.
Because all the effort and all the shit he was doing then finally just paid off when he was like 40.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the
so
thing.
So much work goes into that. Nobody notices because you guys don't have 9-to-5 jobs and people just typically think, oh, well, you can just show up and do that.
Yeah, people think he, you know, people are like, Louis C.K. is, you know, biggest star in the world now and I'd never heard of him 5 years ago. That must mean he's an overnight success. No, no, that's not what it means at all.
He's doing a lot of things.
And the cool thing about stand-up comedy is that it's not a job like where if my dream at 6 was to be a comic, if it had been to be an athlete, to play football or baseball and say that I had gotten to do that. I'm 35 now. Now would be about the time where I'm thinking of retiring from, you know, my glory days would be behind me if I was in the NBA or the NFL. But with comedy, it is something that if you're tenacious, if you stick with it, and if you, you know, continually make the sacrifices and continually work on your craft, it's one of those things where you just continue to get better. You don't peak. It's not a physical thing. Like even, you know, even a golfer doesn't have to retire at 35, but at 60, he doesn't have the power and his drive that he had in 30 and all that. Louis C.K. just keeps getting better because he keeps working on it. I feel my second album is stronger than my first because in 3 years I've gained more muscle and more confidence, and I'm hoping that my next album is even better than this one, and you keep getting better. So it is possible to bust your ass and toil for 20, 30 years and then catch a break, you know? The thing that we always say is just be undeniably funny. Be so funny that at some point the industry has no choice but to embrace you.
That's a great philosophy. It's a real
positive way to look at it. And you mentioned it being lucrative. It's like, you know, people may think, oh, you know, these guys, they're just sitting around on a Tuesday afternoon, just, you know,
smoking pot, just podcasting, out, like, video
oh, man,
games.
They must have just like a bag full of money. I'm like, no, I do this because I love it, not because like
you're
getting any dough out of it. It takes a lot. It really is to be involved in the media and radio and stand-up comedy and writing. I mean, you hear all the time that you suck, and it's just not for people who have thin skin. You really have
to
pull
yourself
up.
It's easy to say you suck when you're sitting behind a phone or a keyboard and you haven't done anything at all that has to do with that. And
yeah.
Like, I can say this and go on about my day.
Yeah, I remember being out of school, and when I graduated college, I was like, okay, this is what I got to do. I got to get a job on a salary where I wear khakis every day. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but I dipped my toes in that, and that was not the life for me. Yeah. So now, you know, we're living the life here on the Wild West and trying to – you know, break into radio and podcasting and writing. And it's really cool to talk to guys like you who are really passionate about that same thing and have had levels of success and whatnot. And I think it's really good for people who are really trying to make a name for themselves. And just, you know, that really wasn't the direction I was thinking about taking the conversation today, but just kind of really thinking about it and getting maybe a little retroactively thinking about my thoughts over the past few months. And it just kind of hit me at a moment, and I really think it was a callback to the article. It just seems so, I don't know, it just seems so full of life, and you know, and I like that, and I just really gravitate towards that. So,
oh, cool. Well, I'm glad you like. I hope I'm going to be doing more writing for them. So
awesome, man! I'm really looking forward to it.
I've got a question for you.
Sure.
Since you when did you record your album?
August.
Okay, you recorded your album, the Unintentionally White album. Available at KevinBartini.com, iTunes, and Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
Once you write an album, does that kind of just burns a whole hour of material, doesn't it? Or do you slowly mix it in?
In a way, kind of the process is a process that actually George Carlin invented, which is the process that I use, which is he would basically, when he recorded an HBO special, when he was, you know, physically that night on stage recording, he already had the date booked to do the next one, so which was 18 to 24 months later. So the once he stepped off that stage, the pressure was on him that he needed to come up with another hour and get it to the point where it's ready to be released as an album that will be out there judged forever. So how he did it, would he would get off stage and the very next night, if you were to see him the night after he taped an HBO special, you would see 90 to 95% of what he did the night before on the special, but he'd already be replacing bits and jokes and out with the old and in with the new as a gradual process. And you know, so ideally halfway through, 9 months, 12 months in, you would be seeing him with a brand new hour that then for the next 9 to 12 months he would be polishing and refining and then putting out as a special and doing all over again. So that's how I went about this. Now, I don't have George Carlin's talent, and I also don't have George Carlin's ability to do 90 minutes at any theater in the country I want night after night to do this. So my process took 3 years, which I'm happy with. I'm like, if he could do it in 18 months and I can do it in 3 years, that's pretty good, and let's hope that the next one's a little less. So I'm actively trying to – right now I'm in this position where I can come to a town, and I'm because I'm not a national name, I'm not a big name, most of the people coming to the show still aren't coming because I'm a draw. They're not coming to see me. They're coming because it's a comedy club and it's a Saturday night and yeah. It's catch as catch can. They're just coming to see a comedy show. I am starting to get a handful, a smattering of people who are, you know, are fans of mine who've seen my stuff. So for them, I want to make sure that I'm working in new material, but I'm at a place where, you know, I'm starting to get to do new rooms and places I haven't been. I want to go in and crush and make a good first impression on that club. So I'm actually at a point right now where I'm not doing the Unintentionally White album start to finish. I'm doing the best of the Unintentionally White album, the best of Showing the Horses Who's Boss, and new stuff mixed in. So okay. I'm really, you know, can really just kill right now and then and meanwhile be working on new things. Because I don't feel like I burned it. There's a way of saying I don't feel like I burned it because most of the audience has never seen anything that I've done. Yeah, or, you know, or they saw that I was going to be there, you know, I'm going to be at that club. And like I said, they're going just because it's a comedy show and maybe looked me up on YouTube that afternoon and watched one set and was like, okay, he's funny. So maybe they're familiar with 5 minutes of it. So I'm not to the point yet where I can't do a routine and feel like the audience is checking their cell phones because they've heard it a dozen times.
Well, I had honestly just always wondered that question because I know that like it's difficult as hell to come up with that much material and then just, like, if you record a special or an album, like, I didn't know if there was a process of just, like, do you have a backup hour just ready or whatever? And I assumed that was not the case, but
yeah.
It must be very difficult to just immediately, like, here's new stuff all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, but also, I mean, that's a bit of where improv comes from, crowd work comes from. That's where a lot of my stuff, my material, my process comes out of, you know, messing around on stage. And I do a lot of still open mics or produced shows at bars and stuff here in New York. I go out to Brooklyn and I perform at in a back of a bar, or I go up to the Bronx and I perform in a bookstore on a Tuesday night. I go where small audiences, where there's no industry that matters, where I can just, you know, just riff, just have an idea, have a theme, have some little kernel, and just force myself to talk about it for 10 minutes and see if a couple of laughs come out of that and record myself. And maybe, you know, like, for example, I did that. I went up to the bookstore and somebody who had been on before me was talking about some childhood memory or something. So I just went up and talked about my childhood and talked about what it was like to play Little League in my town. And I just forced myself to just ramble. And I got some laughs. I was like, okay, well, there's an idea, maybe a new bit in there. So now I'm going to go listen back to that tape, see what actually got the laughs, and see how I can string those laughs together and keep expanding on it. So that's kind of the process and how you do it. And then after a little while, you've strung those laughs together, you kind of put it to memory, you understand it, and now you can start, it can go in my act where something else, mm-hmm. you know, is coming out. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah, I don't want to, I'm personally tired of doing a lot of my material. I want nothing more than 20 new minutes so that I can stop at this point doing the dog shit bit because I've refined it, or doing whatever, you know, whatever bit, pumpkin fucker or one eyed man in the elevator and stuff like that. I don't want
to. Pumpkin fucker was my personal favorite.
Is that your favorite? Yeah. That's the pumpkin fucker routine. Actually, tell you about that. That was my, that's of all those bits, that's the oldest one on the album. That is, I wasn't even sure if I was going to put it in there. That's like, that bit was my Aristocrats, which okay, I saw the Aristocrats movie, mm-hmm. and I saw that process of just how you can take, you know, take one thing and how many filthy jokes and stuff you can add on to it and add on to it and add on to it. So that whole summer that movie came out, mm-hmm. I just did this. I made up this story about going to the Halloween parade in the village and seeing a guy fucking a pumpkin and how much I can add into it. And so I probably at one point got that bit up to 15, 20 minutes.
Oh, wow.
And then I had to refine it and get it back in. And, you know, now it's, I think on the album, it was probably 5 or 6 minutes of this wild. And if you can do a story like that or something like that, that chews up a lot of time. Those are good. You know, you get an entire idea and or of a bit, and it can string out. You know, the dog shit bit, that was like 7 minutes. It all came out of having to walk a dog and pick up his shit. It just becomes 7 minutes because you have a lot to say on it. So that's the process a little bit.
But why don't we shift over to our movie section of the podcast. Kevin, you are the host of the Movie Preview Review.
Mm-hmm.
And you obviously just watch previews and then review the movie based on that. Cole goes and sees the movies. And I also have only seen the trailer, so what we're going to do today is review Inherent Vice. And if you haven't seen the trailer, we're going to put it up on our website, pastthegravypod.com. So, Kevin, do you want to just give us what you got from the trailer so far?
Yeah, all right. So, Inherent Vice, it's Paul Thomas Anderson directed, which is a good thing. I like Paul Thomas Anderson, but I have been burned by a couple of his movies in the past that I was really excited about. They were awful. But this one looks like Paul Thomas Anderson is doing his best version of The Big Lebowski, is what I get out of it. I feel like, I feel like Joaquin Phoenix is just the dude. It's the same story as The Big Lebowski. He's just some hapless, keeps to himself stoner who gets himself, pulled into some, you know, this wild story of double cross and intrigue and beautiful women and sex and violence, which he, you know, all because he picked up a phone or something like that. So to me, first, when I see a movie that just seems to be a ripoff of another movie that I liked, that doesn't excite me. That turns me off to it. But it's got a lot of great things going for it. It's got a great cast, even down to supporting roles by Martin Short. Looks like Reese Witherspoon was in there a little bit. Josh Brolin and Owen Wilson and Joaquin Phoenix stars as the dude. So there's a lot of, and it just feels a bit more fun, Paul Thomas Anderson fun, you know, where, like a Boogie Nights as opposed to The Master, you know. So I would go so far as to say that I would see this one, and I would even probably go see it in the theater. It does look like it's pretty cool.
See, I thought it looked kind of like a Fear and Loathing type movie crossed with a Pulp Fiction feel.
Oh, yeah?
And it was weird because it kind of seems like you see a plot in the beginning of it, and then it just goes completely everywhere else for the rest of the trailer.
I'm always concerned also with a movie when it feels like so much of the preview is showing. It seems like, to an extent, the most interesting thing about the movie is the costumes and the set design, and because mm-hmm. it's set in 1970. So, is there actually substance to the movie? Is it an interesting movie, or is it just 2 hours of watching people look ridiculous in 1970s attire?
Right.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, do you remember that movie American Hustle that came out a little while ago?
Mm-hmm.
That movie kind of did that thing. Like, it was a decent story with a good cast and stuff like that, but it just kind of seemed like it kind of just ventured into just, like, more camp material than actually, like, a legitimate period piece.
And I think they all dress silly.
Yeah, and I think this movie kind of does the same thing, but it's a little more ham-fisted, like in a little more intentionally.
So why don't you give us your version
of
that? Okay,
and why I thought this was so fascinating, at least to talk about with you, is I do not like watching movie previews. I like to kind of go in as blind as possible. And I did see the trailer for this movie just because I am a big Paul Thomas Anderson film, and I can totally see how people have been burned by him in the past. Like, he does not do any of the work for you. He wants to be very vague and throw these very bleak themes, and just a lot of stuff is thrown at you. You can't really take it in one viewing, and sometimes that turns people off. And with that, with your comments being said, this one does the exact same thing. And I was expecting you to initially just not like the movie because Reese Witherspoon was in it. Because I remember that you talking about going to see Legally Blonde 2 and walking into the arcade three times because it's just an abhorrent piece of shit.
Spending $20 on video games.
Which that it is, but luckily she's only in three scenes, and pretty much the whole time she's kind of she gets burned and she does not paint herself in a good light. But that's neither here nor there in terms of the overall quality of the film.
Well, I should say about that, I don't blame Reese Witherspoon for Legally Blonde 2. I mean, there's something to be said for an actress taking a big payday. You know, she didn't write Legally Blonde 2 and direct it and everything else. She starred in it and made probably, you know, $12 million to do so. Whoever it is, if this had said from the producer and director of Legally Blonde 2, yes, then I would have shit all over. But Reese Witherspoon is in general very likable actress, charming. I liked her, you know, in Election, I loved her in Walk the Line. And actually, here she is with Joaquin Phoenix again. I just realized.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Nice connection. God, I don't want to take us down a rabbit hole, but I do want to just say that Election seriously is one of the smartest and just one of my all time favorite films. I just think it's so great. But
it's streaming on Netflix right now. We just watched it.
Need to go watch it.
You do need to watch it. It's fantastic. So
yeah, a little bit of fun trivia for you on that. Yeah. Just a side note on Election. Yeah. That was filmed in the high school where my wife went. She had graduated the year before. That was her high school.
And, wow. No joke. Yeah. Wow, that's awesome. Yeah.
So whenever we watch it, she points out, you know, that's the stage that she was on and all that.
Very cool.
I don't know. That's trivia.
Yeah. The movie Rushmore was filmed right around the corner where we're shooting and recording. And I'm just like, I drive by and I just see it. And I'm just like, oh, my gosh. Like, I nerd out for Wes Anderson.
I haven't seen that movie, so.
Okay, we'll talk about Inherent Vice then.
Now, of course, that stuff doesn't matter. Everything gets filmed in front of my building. Like, it's a constant.
You live in New York.
Yeah, it's just like,
well. Now, when you're in Nebraska and they film it in high school, it's a big deal. When you're in New York and they're filming on your block, it's a pain in the balls to park.
Yeah,
is all it.
And you just see the cast of girls, you know, skipping by every day. It's just like, oh my gosh, really? So Inherent Vice, though, I think it was a really smart film, and why I think that is, this movie it showed you a lot of the plot details and a lot of the exposition that she was giving at the beginning is kind of just tossed away, I guess, so to speak. It's more so kind of like, and the movie's like an observation on people. So if you enjoy people watching and enjoy like eccentric conversations, and it's not as, then I think that you'll like it. And if you're not really so much worried about, you know, who done it or what's going to be the end of the film, I think it more so is just a really awesome, it takes place in an awesome part of American culture, kind of like this post-Vietnam thing where there's like a really like a big power struggle in terms of, you know, are we going to go for this wavy gravy hippy dippy stuff, or are we going to have more, like you saw the Josh Brolin character, he was this crew cut guy, and you can just assume that he's like this hard nose, and the movie describes him as he represents the squares of the world and is a civil rights abusing detective that works for the LAPD. And what the movie does is it sets up this really awesome relationship with Joaquin Phoenix and Bigfoot is his name, that's kind of made up of Joaquin Phoenix reacting to these radical actions that that Josh Brolin makes. And I don't want to spoil them for anybody, but it really shows well this the power struggle between the hippies and like the squares of the world, because, you know, he's part of the counterculture that just wants to sit back and just smoke pot all day and just kind of, you know, dude about the world and just kind of do his own thing and just be a bumbling fool. But it really does it in this smart way that is kind of winking at you, but not in a way that that is really kind of making itself overtly satirical. What I liked about it a lot was the fact that it did pay an homage to like these hard-boiled detective movies, but it did it in a way that was funny and not so easily digestible, which I think that this movie really warrants multiple watchings. So if somebody is really kind of turned off by a 2.5-hour movie of Joaquin Phoenix making strange noises and smoking zigzags, then I don't think that people will enjoy it because it does make you work. But I think as an overall experience, it's very rich, and I think that there's a lot to take away from it. But
Can I cut in real quick? You said 2.5-hour movie. Is it just me, or is it like every other movie now is almost 3 hours?
Well, I just thought the same thing. Maybe it's because I'm getting all the, you know, I'm getting all the screeners in the mail now because it's award season. But every movie seems to be, and some of them feel it, and some of them don't. But it seems to be so many movies now. If we were back in the VHS days, would be the double VHS things you'd have to take home from the
Titanic.
Yeah. I remember Titanic. Yeah, everybody.
That was the first one I ever remember having too.
But yeah, I mean, you know, yeah, it is award season, and this film is going to get overlooked completely, which is fine. I get it. You know, a guy playing Stephen Hawking and a guy playing, you know, the guy who solves the Imitation Game with Benedict Cumberbatch has much more Oscar appeal than that, and that's fine. But I think that also kind of makes this movie a little more. It kind of aligns with the whole sentiments of the movie. It's not really trying to impress you. It's kind of like, oh, well, you know, here's this piece of, you know, this film, and, you know, you can kind of take it at face value and dislike it, or you can kind of maybe, you know, think a little extra and put in a little work. And I know, you know, some people have kind of aren't really into doing that sort of thing, and you can kind of take it for what it is. And I don't know. I really heard a lot of negative things going into the movie, and so maybe that's why I liked it so much. You kind of have to turn something off to let this whole thing in. And his past two films, this film kind of does the same thing as in The Master. So if you didn't like The Master, it's a completely different movie with a completely different performance by Joaquin Phoenix, but it does make you work pretty hard to maybe figure out what's going on.
I just found The Master to be pretty well boring throughout. But this scene from what I've seen, that it doesn't feel like it's going to be boring. If it nothing else, I feel like you're going to be entertained, even if you have to do the work, really pay attention to plot things.
Yeah,
I just felt the Master, just another movie that was, you know, 2.5-3 hours but felt like six.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, no, it really did. I rewatched it on Netflix the other day, and I do like it. But it took me two settings, I think, to watch it. I was watching it with my lady friend, and she's just like, she just couldn't take it anymore, and it was just absurd. But when you bring it up that way, yeah, this film does have a little more life. It does have, you know, the groovy music and the groovy, you know, the groovy clothes to look at, and it does kind of feel a little effortless in terms of that. The product or the production design and the costuming doesn't really insist upon itself. It just kind of exists and is allowed to breathe and stuff like that. So I thought it was really awesome.
Would you rate it?
It's rated. Oh, it's rated R.
No, what would you? Your rating of it?
I gave it 4.5 stars in my review out of a possible 5. And maybe that was me being a little warm on it initially, just because I am so, you know, inclined to like Paul Thomas Anderson's work. But I do think it at least is a 4-star film, and I'm definitely going to go see it again in theaters. I got to go to a press screening of it, which was awesome. So I actually am going to pay the, you know, $15, I guess, is what it takes to go see the movie. And
at least.
Yeah, so I think it's definitely worth checking out.
I think it looks interesting, and I would see when we do our podcast, the movie preview review, we kind of go around the horn and discuss, well, you know, in what scenario will you see this? There's the best compliment is I'm going to put down $15 hard-earned money and just go see it. Or, you know, the next is, well, I'm a comic, so if I'm on the road in Ohio and I've got a Friday afternoon with time to kill, okay, I'll go see it. Otherwise, I'll wait for it to come out on Netflix or something like that, you know, or I'll never see it. So for me, this one feels like, okay, it's got me. I'll go to the theaters and I'll make this a date night and actually spend the money and go see it. It seems like 2.5 hours, if that's the running time, doesn't dissuade me, because I feel like maybe, you know, Pulp Fiction was that long, but I was entertained from start to finish.
Yeah, Absolutely. Yeah, you're going to meet a lot of interesting characters in this film, and I think that this is the kind of movie, since, like I said, it is so intricate, to actually go to the movies and actually just let it wash over you and just be engulfed in this world. Because otherwise, at home, like, I like watching, smart films as much as the next guy, but I guarantee it, before it's all said and done, no matter how much I like the movie, I'm going to pick up my phone and I'm definitely going to go through my Twitter feed. And in this time, you know, I'm not going to, but maybe that's just me.
Yeah.
There's just that distraction of, you know, oh, I can just pause this and go do something for a second or whatever. But this is a movie that I think, like, kind of like Interstellar, one I think that you should definitely go see in theaters.
Yeah. Now, I'll tell you the movie that, excuse me, we've got, you know, because we got the screeners.
Uh-huh.
And we do, when we watch the screeners, we do, you know, leave our cell phones in the bedroom. Uh-huh. And
okay.
Computers off, and you just sit and watch, and you know, you commit to it when it's the first time you see it. But this past weekend, we watched, and I'm interested to get your take on this. We watched Boyhood.
Okay. What did you think? I'm gonna watch that tonight. I'm looking forward to it.
What do you think?
I've seen it. I've seen it, I think, three times now. Okay, so that
really?
I've seen it. I've watched it three times. I saw it at a screening, and then I went on my own to go see it in theaters, and then I watched it. I watched the screener at home, and I do want to preface this by saying I am incredibly impressed by how much integrity you have to put your phone in another room and your computer up. That is that is awesome, because I don't have that.
That's some professional shit.
Yeah, it kind of makes me feel like crap based upon my chosen together, profession. Cool. So anyway, but Boyhood, man, you know, it's obviously an amazing cinematic achievement. Richard Linklater's a hometown boy. From
Sam Houston State University, yeah. Eat 'em up, cats.
He's from Texas, and he talked about it recently on, I think he was on Marin and whatnot. But, yeah, man, I thought it was really awesome how it gave it heightened the mundane. It really showed some amazing scenes that you would just see in everyday life. There was no
it's literally just
dread.
About somebody
was,
growing up, right?
Right. Yeah. There's no dramatic plot points. It's just, this is this kid in Texas, and it shows him growing up from 6 to 18, and he just, you know, you see him bouncing around. His parents are split, you know, from one stepdad to another stepdad who
just
drinks.
Like Linklater's, right?
Yeah, and it's awesome. I mean, what makes me think of that is, okay, in a typical movie, there's usually something like, let's just take Walk the Line, for example. His brother dies, and so that affects him for his entire life. There's a scene with these four guys, and they're talking about girls, they're talking about getting laid and stuff like that, and they, you know, and they're throwing these saw blades against a wall and into like a piece of cardboard in like a house, the house that hasn't been finished. And you think like, oh my gosh, you know, I remember seeing this for the first time. Is that going to, like, you know, chop off one of their hands? And it doesn't happen. It really just exists in this space of everyday life. And it's very naturalistic. And it's very – and, you know, there's stars in there. Ethan Hawke's in it. Patricia Arquette's in it.
How crazy is it, though, to keep a cast together for that span of time?
Well, there's a lot of stuff that goes into it, because they didn't know how the kid was going to turn out. It just so happened to kind of work for the sentiments of the movie. He's a very artistic guy. And you'll see that growing up, he's a free thinker and whatnot. And I do like it. I do think it is a great film. It wasn't my personal favorite movie of the year, but I definitely think that it at least did something. It provided a novel concept that's actually getting like some of the best attention. I mean, it just won the Golden Globe for Best Picture Drama the other day. But what did you think about it, Kevin?
I am 180 degrees opposite from you. It was the most boring 3 hours that felt like 13 hours. I hated it. I mean, it was a gimmick to follow a kid for 12 years, which is a smart thing. Nobody's ever done it. It's ambitious. It's a gimmick. But boy, did they get poor casting. I mean, the kid was adorable at 5 or 6, but from there on out, I'm telling you, you just spent 12 years following the least charismatic person in the world. He was so boring, just as a human being who has no stage presence, no screen presence, no charisma. The fact, you know, it's a great movie for Ethan Hawke, because mm-hmm. Ethan Hawke, who is a decent actor and is, you know, at times a movie star, but never has gotten to the level of movie star of, like, a Tom Cruise level.
Right.
When you put an Ethan Hawke-level star up in the same scene with this absolute zero, he comes across like Tom Cruise. Like, he's the bright, shining star, the world's greatest movie star in comparison to everything else. I think it's a great idea, follow a kid around, but there was no plot. There was no bad guy. There was nothing happened. It's like, yeah, nobody even cuts their finger on a blade. Uh-huh. I hated every second of this movie after the first 5 minutes, and my wife is the same way. We were just like, and it gets to this point where, you know, I'm not Alex, you haven't seen it. I'm not spoiling the end.
You can tell me if it's bad. I don't care.
It gets to this point where you're 2.5 hours in, and he graduates high school, and I'm like, okay, well, this must be the end. He's graduated high school. That's a great place to button it. And there's 25 more minutes of nothing happening. I cannot imagine how, other than people just being like, what a great idea to do this. It's a great idea, poorly executed, because they, you know, because it's a gamble when you're going to follow one person for 12 years. You don't know that that person is going to be uncharismatic and boring. And the fact that he strung it out for 3 hours was just, I felt like punishing us. I can't believe somebody has seen it three times. I will never watch it.
Well, so, okay.
He spent almost 10 hours of his life watching
it. I'm totally with you. I think that all those points are incredibly valid, because it's totally true, because I was sick. I am sick of hearing about, oh, how this, I have a colleague who just claims that this is the greatest film ever, and how,
didn't it
how
just
much
clean
is just,
up on Sunday?
Do what?
Didn't it win a bunch of stuff on
Sunday? Yeah. That's what I mentioned. And it's probably going to take Best Picture. I mean, like, at least right now as it stands. But, and I don't think it, you know, I'm just kind of sick of hearing about how this really is, you know, the epic and technical, here's what the Rotten Tomatoes tomato meter says. Epic and technical scale, but breathlessly intimate in narrative scope. Boyhood is a sprawling investigation of the human condition. I don't think it really strives to be all that. And I it's just refreshing for me to hear somebody who didn't like it, because I am so sick of hearing it premiered at Sundance 12 months ago. Oh my gosh, you know, Richard Linklater's really tapped into something that nobody else has. And yeah, it is. And
is
the
it
reason
shot
why
documentary
I saw,
style or
No, it's shot. No, it's shot like a narrative. But
okay.
But why I saw it the third time at home is cuz I saw it the first time and I was like, "Oh, that was good. I liked it." But it didn't grab me because I heard expectations of friends who saw it at South by Southwest saying, oh, you know, this, you're just going to love it. So I saw it in June or July. I was like, okay, I liked it. So I saw it again in theaters, and I liked it even less. And I was like, okay, maybe – and I do still really like the film. But – and then I guess I had a bad experience, and then I saw it a third time at home, and I liked it more. I guess I just kind of feel like it's my fiduciary duty to watch the movie this many times. But – I don't know. I don't think that it will be one of those movies that I will revisit years and years. I much prefer a film by him like Dazed and Confused or something like that.
Oh,
that's
sure.
I mean, that to me is just, you know, that's incredible. Maybe that's just because it's had 22 years to kind of, you know, be a movie, and this movie's been 6 months old, and I'm just fucking sick of hearing about Boyhood. Like,
I think if you had 22 years or 22 minutes, if you just sat somebody down who's never seen a Richard Linklater film and has no previous knowledge of either of these movies, and you say, here, you have 2 days, you watch in whatever order, here's Dazed and Confused, and here's Boyhood. I'm going to go out and say, my feeling is 98% of the people are going to be like, I can't believe these are from the same director. Dazed and Confused was 90 minutes or 120 minutes of characters that were interesting and scenes that stood on their own as interesting and funny and people who were charismatic and who it was a really good movie. This one I just felt was a plodding 3 hours of boredom. And then when you're doing a kid's adolescence and his life, I don't know. And it just, and then it's just hitting these mundane moments. It's not his, you know, the things that all guys go through growing up, the discovery of you know, his first Playboy magazine, you know, that kind of stuff. The first girlfriend, it kind of hits on that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I was just if you're gonna do it, it's a cool idea. I just feel it's a big gamble, and then you end up having a kid who doesn't. I you know, who just doesn't come across as somebody you'd ever want to. I never want to see this guy in another movie. I don't think he can carry a film, couldn't carry a scene. I was just, I just couldn't have been more bored. And frankly, to tell you the truth, with the screeners we've gotten this season, I haven't really fallen in love with any movie. I didn't love Birdman. I liked the theory of everything, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I liked that one. That's my favorite so far. He did an amazing performance.
Uh-huh.
And I think that movie so far gets my vote for the best picture for what should be in the nominees. And Eddie, what's his name? Eddie Redmayne?
Yeah, Eddie Redmayne.
He deserves the Oscar for it. My fear is that he won't get it. He's going to get looked over for some reason the way that John Hawkes did a couple years ago when he played the quadriplegic.
Yeah.
That was one of the best performances I've ever seen, and he didn't even get nominated.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. My feeling is that the buzz is all about Boyhood because of what a grand experiment it was to dedicate 12 years of your life and to keep coming back. And what a gamble it is, because any of those, you know, that kid, he could have gotten, you know, hit by a car at some point, and then all the money and everything you put into it is done, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
I just think it's getting a lot of points for not for what it's achieved, but for what it attempted.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't really think that that's and I don't think that that's fair to give a movie so much a praise just because it has an interesting device and conceit. You know, I mean, I don't know. I don't know. And I'm with you on this year. It just seems like a lot of the Oscar films, none of them have really gotten me. I saw Birdman in theaters, and yeah, it was a cool like one take kind of thing, and with some good performances. It was good to see Michael Keaton, Edward Norton.
Yep.
Edward Norton was fine. He was good. They had an interesting dynamic. But to me, overall, I left the movie just kind of being like meh, like
yeah.
it just didn't grab me. There was nothing for me. The magical realism in the film didn't really work for me. And as a person who's a critic, it kind of seemed like this movie just kind of hated me. Not that I'm, you know.
My feeling with Birdman was I liked it a lot. I liked it throughout. I felt that it didn't need that supernatural element at all.
Right.
I thought if you didn't have that, it would have been my pick for Best Picture. It was a great idea of a, you know, story of a actor who is the big popcorn hole actor 20 years ago, who's now trying to stage his own comeback by producing a Broadway show by a little, you know, of a play by a little known writer and all, like, great. All that is great. I loved all the performances. I just felt the supernatural element just
was
out.
And then he flies.
And the ending, which again, because your listeners haven't heard of the ending, felt the last 7 minutes of the ending felt tacked on. I felt like it originally should have ended on stage, you know, and I felt like that probably is where it originally ended, and then everything after that felt like a group watched an early screening and thought the ending was too bleak, so they created this whole other fantasy ending that just felt tacked on.
Yeah.
I felt like that movie didn't have the supernatural element. I keep comparing it to Dusk Till Dawn. I loved the first half of Dusk Till Dawn, and I wish that that movie had just continued like that.
Uh-huh.
Once they went into the titty bar and it became a brand new movie,
mm-hmm.
I liked that movie in and of itself, and I like a supernatural movie in and of itself, but when you put them together, you're getting oil and water with me. You're not getting chocolate and peanut butter.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And what I think what drew me – and I knew I wanted to see the movie anyway just from the praise it had been getting. So I saw it, and what I liked what it was trying to go for, kind of like how it was trying to do this, like kind of like it was live, like it was happening, like theater.
Yeah.
You know, like – and it does, you know, it's like – but to me, that with – that idea wasn't fully realized because it kind of seemed like it was supposed to be like jazz, but it really wasn't jazz. It was obviously very scripted and very, you know, very calculated. And to me, that really kind of made a lot of the stuff fall apart for me.
Yeah.
At least in the entire structure of the movie. Yeah, because, you know, a good performance by Edward Norton isn't going to make me say I like a movie. I think that cheapens it. But, and I think that the themes that it was doing, it was very heavy-handed and a little pretentious as far as I'm concerned. And I just took a step back from that, and it didn't do it for me.
Yeah. It was not a bad movie compared to, compared to Boyhood.
Right.
It's Citizen Kane, but, I didn't love it. It's just, again, I'm off the, I'm off the off the radar with what seems like to be the popular consensus on both of those movies. I feel like I'm in the minority on them.
Yeah, and it's nice to hear. I'm glad that we got a different voice upon Boyhood on here, because I think that at least it just kind of seems like somebody. I don't know. It's just nice to hear a different perspective, basically. And also that John Hawkes movie, I'd forgotten the name of it, was The Sessions, if anybody was curious about that.
Which was an excellent movie, and he was amazing in that.
Yeah, with Helen Hunt. Yeah, that was strange to see her back from the 90s, back from the dead.
But it was nice to see her front, if you know what I mean.
Oh, yeah. So anyway, yeah, we've had some
She shows her boobies, Alex. She shows her boobies.
Now I'm watching it.
Yeah.
See, you're also way more fun for Cole to talk to you about movies, because I'm usually just like, when are the boobs coming out? And then that's pretty much the end of
you
the
You saw Birdman, didn't you?
I did see Birdman.
Did you like it?
I liked Birdman. It was just, I mean, I kind of felt the way he did about it. Uh-huh. I liked it, and I appreciated it, but I thought it went a little longer than it should have, and like the whole like him being a superhero thing kind of was weird to me.
Okay.
Yeah. Did you feel the same about that ending? Didn't it feel tacked on?
No, it felt like it should have ended on stage. I completely agree with you, and that would have made it so much better, more powerful of an ending.
Yeah, or even if they wanted to take it into the hospital room, so you got that final joke of the way he looked. Possibly, you know, but beyond that, that's where I thought it should have ended. The rest of it just...
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, it just seemed too bookended to me, and I didn't like that. I don't know. But yeah, it would have definitely been way more artsy if they would have ended it on stage, and way more, you know, kind of romantic to the stage, because the whole movie is about
I guess I keep going back to it.
Yeah, the movie is about the romance of the stage.
It's
and
like
how,
him putting on a
and
play.
How
that's
yeah,
part of the
I mean,
story.
And that's incredible. I mean, to own it, you don't get mm-hmm. take two. You know, when
it's
you're
gotta
on stage.
It's got to be there. It's got to be then. It's got to go.
Yeah,
right.
and you know, and there was really good stuff of that, like the scene where Edward Norton and Michael Keaton are working out that scene on stage. I thought that was amazing to see, because you see these two incredible actors working on something like that, working on material, and you're like, you do kind of feel like, and this is kind of a theme of like the show, you do get like an inside baseball kind of look towards it. That's something that I can't see. It's something I can't comprehend to even do. And just to see it in that on that scale, I thought it was pretty awesome. But other than that, the movie fell a little flat. And maybe I'll revisit it if I can get it on iTunes or something like that.
That was with Zach Galifianakis in it, and I thought I literally only went to go see it because it was a Zach Galifianakis movie. And I think he kept it like grounded, where it was like it'd get serious and then he'd say something stupid and funny.
Yeah,
it would just make you laugh and it would kind of make it lighter. And he was a good part in it. He was my favorite part to watch, at least.
But yeah, all right. So what else we got, Alex?
Why don't we move on to our questions that our listeners have sent us? It's our answers segment. Cole likes to call it questions for answers, but it's just called answers.
Okay, yeah, I always forget what the name of the segment is.
Kevin, feel free to participate.
All right.
All of this.
Let's do it.
All right. If you have questions to send us, you can send them to us at passthegravypod@gmail.com or on Twitter @passthegravypod, @AlexJMiddleton, @wordsbycole. Okay. @KevinBartini, just to say, hey, I heard you on the podcast. Fantastic. I bought your album.
Yeah, please do. Please do.
Well, our first question comes from Matt Keen, and this is kind of regarding a question we had last week, and somebody last week asked us, who is more important to domestic race relations, and it was Martin Luther King or Dale Earnhardt Jr., and we kind of went off into a spiel of who are famous juniors that we know. And he said, you guys talked about Dale Earnhardt Jr. and Martin Luther King Jr. being in your top 10 list of juniors, who would your top 3 juniors be?
Oh, top 3. All right. Robert Downey Jr.
He's a big one, yeah. Odell Beckham Jr. Obviously the biggest player in football this year, right?
Ken Griffey Jr.
Cal Ripken Jr.
Was he a junior?
Yeah, he had a dad that played too.
No, I know, but I can't remember if he was officially a he never went by junior. Once he became a player, his father started going by senior. But I guess, yeah, technically he's a junior. And then, of course, my favorite, Kevin Bartini Jr.
Right. We actually noticed that when we were signing onto Skype. I was like, oh, hey, why don't we
throw
him on
there? Oh, yeah, that's right. My Skype handle. That's right.
I was like, this is so perfect for this.
So Kevin Bartini Jr. is in the top three, clearly.
Let's see. I guess since we're in Texas, I'm going to go ahead and say Hank Williams Jr.
We don't want to be racist, so we have to throw Martin Luther King in there, right?
Well, I don't think that it's racist to say
wrong.
That. Well, I mean,
three white guys not picking the black guy. I think
that's
Well, I picked Ken Griffey Jr.
Okay.
And I'm going to pick Damon Wayans Jr. because I like him on New Girl.
Yeah.
Floyd Mayweather Jr.?
Nope, I don't like that guy.
Is he a junior?
I think. It said so online.
Okay.
I think there's about 15, if you're going boxing, there's like 15 or 20 George Foreman juniors, right?
Yeah. And he named all of his kids fucking George Foreman. That was a great idea.
Yeah. Even his daughters, I'm pretty sure.
Okay, so let's narrow it down to three then.
Okay.
We'll say Kevin Bartini Jr.
Kevin Bartini Jr.
Robert Downey Jr. is number two.
Yeah.
Cuba Gooding Jr.?
No. He hasn't done a movie in 20 years, man. Well, that's not true.
He's dead, but what about Martin Downey? Was it Martin Downey Jr., the talk show host?
No, I don't.
Martin Downey Jr., there's actually a really good documentary about him. He was, maybe he's a little bit before your time, but he was, he had a show, like one of those, he was like the worst of the sleazy chat show type of thing.
Okay.
Morton Downey Jr.
Morton Downey Morton Jr., okay, yeah, I've Googled him, and now I'm on his Wikipedia page. He does look like a kind of a sleazy guy.
Totally sleazy. He would have...
He looks like this, Shooter McGavin.
He was the type... His show was where Gloria Allred and who's the... And Al Sharpton made their names, like got famous off of being on his show. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
total, shit. Okay.
He would have, like... it was like Springer was a ripoff of his show. His show was and there's a documentary about him. He was an... unabashed, you know, he would smoke a pack a day on the show and talk about, you know, it's American to smoke cigarettes. And, of course, he dies of lung cancer. And right before he dies, he recants all that he'd ever said about it. And it was like, no, getting lung cancer and dying sucks. And he was just for about 2 years, he was like the biggest, most controversial figure in media. And his documentary, I'll put him on the list because the documentary was really interesting.
What, do you know the name of the documentary off the top of your head?
Let me. You know what? I'm on IMDb like right now. I'm just going to put his name in.
I'm looking at a video of this guy, and I don't. I'm pretty fascinated with pop culture, pretty much on every level. I've never heard of this guy, but like I'm looking at him. He's smoking on stage.
Uh huh.
He's got Al Sharpton over here, looking 30 years younger, and it's just kind of a surreal thing to see that guy. Not looking all emaciated and whatnot, but you just wouldn't see that these days. You would not, never, ever see a host smoking a cigarette on stage.
No.
What network was he on?
It was, I believe it was syndicated.
Syndicated, oh, okay.
Al Sharpton looks like Kenan from Saturday Night Live. It looks like he's dressed up like him.
It's called Evocateur. Evocateur.
Tour. All right, we can put that in the show notes as well. Right. That's really fascinating.
Which I think, I saw it on Netflix. I think it's probably still streaming.
All right, let's check it out
on Netflix.
We do this a lot. We should just have a segment where it's like, well, we just look things up and we just have really
the
cool
gang looks up shit.
Here's what it says on their website. It's going into. Hang on, let me pause it on the website. Their website went into a video started. It says about the film. In the late 80s, the masses fixated on a single sociopathic star, Morton Downey Jr. He tore apart the traditional talk format by turning debate of current issues into a gladiator pit. His blow smoke in your face style drew a rabid cult following, but also the title Father of Trash Television.
Oh, shit. Yeah. It's
good documentary.
It's streaming on Netflix right now, too, so it is on there. And it's a brisk 89 minutes. You can watch that twice before you watch Boyhood once.
You can watch any 7 seconds of that documentary and get more enjoyment than 3 hours of Boyhood. Vock to it. Yeah.
Cool.
So, Morton Downey Jr., Kevin Bartini Jr., and Robert Downey Jr. are our top three, then?
Sure. I would, honestly, I don't know. Maybe Freddie Prinze Jr. I don't know. Is he anybody?
Freddie Prinze Jr.?
He writes for the WWE, so maybe I thought that was kind of interesting.
Is that what he does now?
Yeah, he's like the head writer for the WWE.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, you would not think that. I mean, you just think of him in teen comedies. That's kind of how I think of him. But, so we can...
Freddie Prinze Jr. is a better-looking version of the kid from Boyhood. Just an empty shirt with no charisma, nothing.
Yeah. Yeah, he's got a better looking mug, is all.
Well, we move on to our next question then.
Oh, okay, sure.
Did you have something else to add?
No, I'm good.
No? Mm-mm. All right. Vince Terrio, or The Riot, depending on how you're pronouncing it, says, if every statue in the world came to life, which area would be in the most trouble? I'm going to guess
Washington,
like,
D.C.
Ooh. Yeah.
No, I'm pretty sure Washington, D.C. has the record for most, at least most monuments, and most of them are statues.
I was thinking, like, Greece or Rome or, like, the Colosseum and have all, like, the statues of David and everything?
But what's the threat of those? Most of those statues are missing their arms and legs anyway.
No, a good one is those.
They can come to life and they'll just lay there like John Hawks.
What about those terracotta warriors in Japan or China? I wouldn't want to fuck with those if they came to life.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one, too.
All I'm thinking about is just the Washington Monument, like, moving around. Dude. But that wouldn't do
it. The Lincoln Memorial, come on, dude, that dude's huge.
Yeah. Can you imagine the Washington Monument coming to life and just ejaculating over the whole city?
It's just like a huge spigot, just...
Yeah.
Because I guess in New York, the Statue of Liberty is going to have to do some swimming, probably. So that's gonna hamper our ability. 300 feet.
And the Statue of Liberty is not... I don't know if you've ever seen it in person. It's not that big. When you finally see it, it's one of the things in New York City that's underwhelming. When you actually
Wait 4.5 hours to like get to the top of it.
It's just covered in bird shit.
Can you even go to the top anymore?
I don't know. There's been times after 9/11 they shut it down, then they open it back up, then they shut it down. Who knows?
I went in 2000 right before that happened. So I got to go up to the crown I think it's the crown, yeah. Wherever it was.
I'm not saying going in. I'm just saying when you see it from Battery Park or when when you go by it on the in a water taxi or something, it's remarkably smaller than you are led to believe in everything you've ever seen in movies or anything else. It's not gigantic. I don't know.
Maybe it's just because we're American and we never came over on like a boat where we were like, oh yes, we're finally free and we can save our families now.
No, it's definitely an impressive statue and all that it stands for. Yeah. It's great. I'm just saying when you physically see it, there's an element that's underwhelming. It's like, oh wow, I thought it was going to be a lot bigger. Where everything else in Manhattan, other than the tree at Rockefeller Center, when you see it, is larger than you expected. That's just the one that just seems, okay, saw it. Moving on.
So Washington, D.C. is our answer then?
Yeah. Yep, my vote's for the Washington Monument is the most deadly. Just
keeping it in America as long as we got the best
support. USA.
All right. Cassie Boyle says, what two brands could combine and make the ultimate product? I don't know.
I don't know what she means by that. Like, does she mean to like make like the best product or like the most like conglomerate? Like,
I guess if they came together to make something, let's pretend they could make like an invention or something. Like that.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to say the MacBook, mm-hmm. and then if you can integrate a fleshlight right into it.
Ooh,
it's the ultimate.
Ooh. I'm saying that's the ultimate with some good POV there on. You got yourself a Nike, sir. That's what you got.
Yeah, just like right at the bottom of a hole right at the bottom of your MacBook.
I honestly don't even know if we need to even have our own guesses. That's just fucking
I was going to say something fucking lame. Like, I was going to say if Walmart and Coca-Cola like made something, it'd be like a powerful product. I don't know if it's the best product. I mean, like, it would definitely have some clout in the corporate world, but that's kind of how I construed the question.
Mine was more of a fat-ass idea. And do y'all have Lupe Tortilla in New York? I'm sure you probably
no. Is that like a fast food chain or something?
A Mexican restaurant.
Yeah, no, we don't have those.
We have a lot of them in Texas.
I've never even heard of that.
They have Lupe Tortilla, and it's fantastic Mexican food. It's not overpriced.
Uh-huh.
They also have Luby's. If you could make Luby's Tortilla, and it's just like a kitchen, but all it is just Mexican food, that'd be fantastic.
Okay, that works.
You know, there's nowhere near as good as a MacBook fleshlight, so
okay.
I'm embarrassing myself. I think you would solve crime if you did that, because everybody would be doing that instead of doing anything else.
Mm-hmm.
All right, then let's move on to our next one, and that's from Neil Helixson. He says, if the pen is mightier than the sword, what is mightier than the pen?
Pen is mightier than the sword. What is mightier than the pen? The gun.
The gun, the Twitter.
In pen, sword, gun, rock, paper, scissors, gun beats all.
Yeah, a gun does beat all.
Right. You don't bring a sword to a gunfight.
And you certainly don't bring a pen to either.
Right, like, who the fuck is like, oh, I brought my pen, don't worry.
Yeah, we're all safe, everybody. Stand behind me. Watch out, he's got a ballpoint. Yeah, it's the gun.
That works. That works.
My vote's for Twitter. I mean, yes, a gun can blow up Twitter, so to speak, but I'm going to have to go Twitter because Twitter has a lot of power.
Okay, I'll give you that.
So, we lost Kevin Martini.
Yeah, we did.
Fuck you, Comcast.
Yeah, I got a little bone to pick with you, Comcast. You motherfuckers. I pay my bill. I pay it on time.
We're bill-paying citizens here.
I am not getting internet, and I paid the bill. That's odd. I feel like if I didn't pay the bill, my internet would be cut off. But it's funny that when it's the other way around, I don't think they're paying me.
No, they're not. And when you run a podcast like Pass the Gravy, a podcast that just insists upon intelligent, lively conversations.
And I'm not intelligent enough. Kevin Martini was filling that gap.
Highbrow humor. You get these things whenever you listen to Pass the Gravy. And Comcast said, no more.
They did. They were done. They were sick of it.
We were trying to answer your questions.
We're trying to answer you guys' questions. And you know what? A lot of other places would just pretend that this didn't happen. But we are here to tell you, shit happens. It cuts out. Sometimes stuff goes out, but we fix it. And we tell you guys what's happening. You're in the trenches with us. It's like you're living the dream with us.
We are not going to sit idly by.
We're not going to just be like, all right, well, I guess the internet's out. We're done.
No.
We may not be able to finish with Kevin Bartini, but don't worry, because we can promote the hell out of his stuff. You can go buy the Unintentionally White album on iTunes, KevinBartini.com, and Amazon. Go get it. We listened to it. It's fantastic. This guy is hilarious.
Yep. He is hilarious. It has a very, like we said at the beginning of the episode, it has a very conversational feel that will draw you in terms of the way it was recorded. The material is relatable, and it is just incredibly funny stuff.
So we are unable to finish with him, and we thank him for coming on our podcast for a third time. I think this is actually the second time we've had technical difficulties, but the other time was Curtis's end. So
who?
Curtis's end. Oh, yeah, it's like we forgot about him because he's not been around,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Fuck you, Kurt.
Why
don't we finish up with our last question?
I don't even know if I want to.
You don't want to now?
No.
You're just going to give up?
I want to save it.
Why should you? But
I'm pissed. I have things I want to do. You know, I have other things I do besides podcast. You know,
I'm not saying you don't. I'm not saying you don't. I know you're a very busy man. But I know that Heather Botang already wrote us in, and I had put it on our sheet that we were going to read. So I felt like it's only fair if we answer her question.
Wait, Heather Botang?
Heather Botang.
I think I know her.
Heather Botang, do you?
I think so.
Maybe that's why she wrote in, because she listens. Maybe she's got a crush on you.
Follow me on Twitter,
hey,
Heather.
Heather.
This is just becoming just a
now
big
we're just
plug
being
fest.
Pervs. This is what happens, Comcast. We'll plug the shit out of everything now.
We're plugging you, Comcast. Everybody should get Comcast service.
And then fucking yell at him. Call Tom on the service, the customer service line, because he's a dick.
This guy, Tom, do you think that they were recording that phone call?
Oh, they said they were.
But he didn't say that you could record on his end.
Right.
So he took issue with that.
Yeah. When I was trying to tell him I was going to record him saying that they might refund my money so I can play it later, he wasn't okay with it. He's like, I do not validate that. And I was like, well, okay. I do.
Huh.
I didn't validate it when you
said
that.
That was a very ambiguous accent you did there.
Well, that was it sounded very Tom-like. That's what Tom
sounded. That is how he sounded.
Let's just say his name may not really be Tom. That would be a guess. Just a guess.
His name might have been Tom.
All right. Our next question is from... Our next and final question is from Heather Botang.
Heather Botang. The titular Heather Botang.
And she says, Dustbusters, Ghostbusters, or Dave and Busters?
I started to answer this question. I said, oh, yeah, Ghostbusters. And then the internet cut off. So, you know, and this isn't really answering the question. But I feel like Comcast and people like this, they're just this huge faceless company. Okay, we give them our money. It's pretty much a necessity at this point to have internet, right? Especially, podcasters.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's... And then,
does this have anything to do with Ghostbusters?
It doesn't. I'm just still pissed about the Comcast thing.
We have to stick to the question. We've got to stay on point right now.
Well,
okay. We can go back to it in a second, but right now...
Okay.
That's it. Dustbusters clean things.
Ghostbusters clean things.
Ghostbusters basically use Dustbusters.
They use proton packs.
But, I mean, it's a glorified dustbuster, if you think about it.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
If you think about it.
It's like a vacuum.
And I think Dave and Buster's is just always fun. Ghostbusters may go into some hairy situations.
Wait. You think Dave and Buster's is fun?
Playing games, hanging out with friends, like having fantastic times. I don't know. Whenever I get the cards now, they don't have coins, do they?
No. Yeah, it's cards. You put it on the card.
You get the card and you swipe it and you get to do the little race car game.
Well, I mean, do you like to go there and get drunk or what? Is that what the deal is?
I honestly can't tell you.
It's kind of expensive.
The most recent time I've been to Dave and Buster's, but every time I've gone, it's always been with like a large group of people that have rented like a party space or something.
Here's my deal with Dave and Buster's.
And I always have a great time.
Here's my deal with Dave and Buster's. Does it sound like I'm about to say something really bad about
it? You just seem very negative about it right now. I'm just guessing.
They have shuffleboard.
And shuffleboard's pretty cool.
Have you ever played shuffleboard? I have played shuffleboard. It's amazing.
Pretty much.
Yeah, absolutely.
Pretty much.
I love going to play shuffleboard. It's great. I mean, yeah, Dave and Buster's are cool. I mean, you're definitely going to get more entertainment in terms of time out of Dave and Buster's than you are from a Ghostbusters.
What if there's a haunted Dave and Buster's? That would actually incorporate all three of those things.
If there was a haunted Dave and Buster's, that would actually be amazing. That would be amazing. A haunted Dave and Buster's with Ghostbusters.
Yeah. Okay, well, there we go. There we go. I would say Dave and Buster's if I had to pick one, though. But I would take the haunted Dave and Buster's.
Can I just say Ghostbusters just because I'm a movie guy?
I'd say Ghostbusters.
So where's that going to leave Dustbuster?
Out in the cold.
Like Comcast.
Just like us. Like Comcast fucking left us. And there's a good segue to end this motherfucker on.
Yep. So, we wanted to just thank Kevin Bartini for coming on the show.
He's a funny dude.
Funny dude, interesting guy, intelligent guy, has a lot of cool things to say, and has a really interesting perspective on comedy and writing, and everybody should check him out.
Yep, definitely. At Kevin Bartini on Twitter, kevinbartini.com. Please go buy his album. And tweet him and let him know you heard him on Pass the Gravy. And you guys can pass the gravy, bitches.
There are more and more assholes in the world than ever before. And I'm going to tell you, most of them are young. Most of them are younger than us. Most of them are in their about 30 and under. Fucking most of them are assholes. It's not their fault. I know you guys are young. I'm sure you're perfectly lovely people. No, you're not. Look at you date rapist looking motherfuckers. All caps on backwards, wearing your fucking basketball shorts with your nuts hanging out. You're assholes, I can tell. It's not your fault, though, fellas. It's not your fault. They're Tyler and Cameron and all the other fucked up names that they gave you that you stuck with for the rest of your lives. I'm sorry about that. It's not your fault, you're assholes, but you are. It's your parents' fault. It's your parents' fault. That's why I'm fine with you living at their house and mooching off of them for the rest of your lives. They fucked you up. It's your fault. It's the baby boomers who had these kids and they've ruined these kids and it's not your fault. It's their fault because what happened was when I was about 7 years old, all of a sudden all the parents got together and decided for some reason that they were going to stop hitting kids and that's where we became assholes. Right? Kid. Don't get me wrong, I'm still an asshole, but it's not my parents' fault. We got hit. They stopped hitting you and they gave you a timeout, which was the worst thing you can do. Because all you've done is you've taken a kid who fucked up, and instead of just teaching him really quick, you send him off to sit on the bottom of the stairs for 10 minutes. And what's he going to do? Is he going to think about what he did and grow? No, he's going to get pissed at you for doing it and be a bigger dick when he comes back off his timeout. Parents got killed. One too many timeouts. Those guys actually plotted a fucking murder. All right, we're gonna wait till Sunday night when they're watching Funniest Home Videos. You get the pump shotgun. I got the Uzi, and we'll take them out of there. Kids stop getting hit. I didn't stop getting hit. I was grandfathered into that shit, just so you know. I was like 10 years old. My little cousin did some shit and got sent to a timeout. I was like, what the fuck is that? And then I got soap in my mouth. It's not too late for us, everybody. Sure, there's a lot of assholes out there. Sure, there are. It's not too late. We can still save the next generation. What we need to do is we need to start hitting kids again. That's what I think. So I think, I believe we should start hitting kids again. But, hear me out, here's what I think. I think you should be allowed to hit children all you want. But you're only allowed to hit other people's kids. How fucking satisfying would that be, first of all? But the thing is, there's a checks and a balances in that, because you have to answer to somebody. You have to answer that kid's parents if you hit them. That's a fucking brilliant plan, right? Well, let me tell you what he was doing. That's perfect. And now I know it gets weird in here, because that's a controversial thing to say, and there's some people in this room who are probably thinking, no, no, Kevin, there is never a time where it's appropriate to hit a child. That is an absolute truth. There's never an appropriate time. You should never hit a kid, ever. And I'm going to tell you something. You're, A, you're wrong, and B, you don't believe it either. You don't believe it's an absolute that they should never, ever, ever hit a child, ever. You don't believe it, and I'm going to tell you why you don't believe it. Justin Bieber has been famous since he was 12. Was there ever a moment you didn't want to kick the fuck out of that guy? A 12-year-old just gave you such fucking self-entitled ire. You just wanted to punch the fuck. I wanted to take him out into a cornfield like Joe Pesci at the end of the scene of Casino, right? You stuck him down and beat him with a baseball bat and make fucking Miley Cyrus watch knowing she was next. See, nothing's absolute.